broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Refresher Wealth with yours truly, Mark Kohler, my amazing co-host, Matt Sorensen, coming to you in the beautiful summer time and hoping that some of you are catching this on a vacation route somewhere, driving in your car, truck, RV, maybe just catching up on your podcast. How's that sound, Matt? That's enticing enough, right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe you're in the Hurt Locker working out, you know, running on the treadmill, suffering, whatever, you know, however we're part of your day, we just appreciate it.
Yeah. Getting ready for that Labor Day marathon that
there you go.
You're on your, and why be on a treadmill in the summer? You should be out running.
Because you live in Arizona and it's an oven outside, you know.
So I forget we're polar opposites.
This summertime, I was like, it's the opposite here, but for those listening, we appreciate you being with us. If you're new, this show is about, you know, helping you save on taxes, protect your assets, living the American dream. And Mark and I are both attorneys, and Mark's CPA. I run a self-directed IRA trust company. And we just feel like we're in the trenches of the small business owner. Those of you entrepreneurs out there, we know your pain and your struggles and the things that excite you too. I feel like we're kindred spirits. So hopefully we can share some tax and legal strategies, things we're doing and seeing clients do on a daily basis.
That's a great introduction, Matt. And I had a little background haze fuzz. I could hear it. I didn't want to bother our listeners. So I turned off my air conditioner to this office. And
wow, that's a sacrifice.
It is. We're going to call this hot podcasting. So,
okay. Like a hot yoga.
Yeah.
Are you wearing your hot podcasting outfit?
I'm wearing Lululemon, baby. And, you know, luckily this is for your ears only, because I'm going to be ripping off clothes during this podcast and only Matt Sorensen will benefit from it.
Or, thank goodness it's audio. Yeah. Mark and I connect on video. Anyways, it's so please spare me. But
Oh, you're in for such a treat today, Matt. You don't even.
Yeah. Well, today's topic is pretty hot and exciting. We're talking about private lending. And this has become a really big area for people to make money, loaning others money. And also for many of business owners, real estate investors who need private money. So this private lending market has grown significantly over the years. And we've seen clients on both ends of it who are lenders and also borrowers. I felt like it'd be good to just kind of lay some ground rules out for those that are doing lending or those that may be borrowing to watch out for some traps and common mistakes that are made.
Boy, Matt, you made that sound so politically correct. I was just going to say, for all you loaning out there and those borrowing, you are jacking it up on a regular basis. For crying out loud. I'm in the biggest mess right now trying to mediate a situation that's just, it's just a crap show. And they were borrowing from this person and that person, notes on napkins and too many lenders. And it just, guys, this show I think is going to be really, really helpful. If you're in the hard money lending business, which many of you might be doing with your IRAs or retirement accounts or individually, which I think is fantastic. I just recorded a piece on that on a YouTube video yesterday. I think that's great. Just do it right. And vice versa. If you're going to borrow money from people, oh my gosh, you do not need the stress of screwing it up and the liability and the criminal liability that can expose mm-hmm. yourself to. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. It's a big topic. And I think, but it's digestible too. That's the one thing I don't want people to feel too overwhelmed about it. And I think, you know, you go get a loan from a bank and you see a mountain of documents and notices and disclosures. That is simplified in the private lending world. But you still want to have some balance, okay, and some documentation. We're just not talking, you know, a foot tall of documents that are going to be signed, but there needs to be some paperwork done. And some procedures. So we'll outline that. But before we get into the main course, you know, we like to give a tax and legal tip. And what are you? Are you giving the tax tip, right, Mark?
Yeah, tax tip. And by the way, I've got this hanging chad. For those that have been through a few years of political voting scenarios, you know what the hanging chad is. I've got this thought that's just bugging me that I closed with. I just said when I was making rambling and ranting right there, I said, it's not that easy. What I meant to say is it's easy to lend and to borrow properly. And so if you do it right, it's not that hard. That's what I meant to say, but I said it's not that easy. It's kind of some people call it a Kohlerism. There's a whole dictionary on ways Mark Kohler can screw up the definition of any word or phrase.
This is true.
Dogs in the cradle, whatever. I'm known to a few doozies.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so tax tip. Can I give the tax tip, Matt? Would that be right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I'm so excited.
I've got my foot in my mouth. All right.
A tax tip you can actually understand and won't put you to sleep.
A tax tip that could save you thousands.
All right, so here's my tax tip. I wanted to talk about startup costs. Now, startup costs appear to be seemingly easy, to use that example again or definition, but they can be a little tricky. So here's what I mean by startup cost. And many of you that have ever seen me give a workshop or read any of my books, I often use the lemonade stand as an example. I think it's just a classic. It's an American icon. So the lemonade stand, let's say you're out there building your little table, your sign, you're picking up ice, you're getting your cups ready to go and everything. You haven't sold a cup of lemonade yet, and therefore you're not in business. The IRS says you're not in business until you make at least one sale. You don't have to have a profit. You just have to have a sale. So what are you in that time period? You are what we define as in startup mode. And every business owner goes through that phase. They're going to spend money before they make money. It's just, there's no way around it. Even if you're just setting up a website, printing some business cards or something. So you want to track those expenses. Now, some of you listening to this podcast, you may have been startup mode for the last 6 months, the last 9 months. Some clients that have been developing a product or an invention, you could have been in startup mode for several years. And the rule is, if those expenses directly relate to the startup of your business and the first sale, they're a write-off. Now, that's the definition, but it can get really complex quickly. So let me give a few points here. First, easy stuff. Any of you out there that are contemplating an investment, a project, a small business, and we have a lot of entrepreneurs listening to our show. That's really our Refresh Your Wealth is all about business owners and investors. Keep track of those expenses. You don't have to have a new checkbook. You don't have to always have another credit card or QuickBooks set up. Just have an Excel spreadsheet. Track those expenses and write them down. That's easy. All of you out there listening, if you haven't made a sale yet, track those expenses and force them on your accountant at the end of the year. Go, look, I'm trying to start a business. Here's my startup costs. And then you're going to want to keep those. And I could even write them off next year. Now that's the concept at the basic level. Now, a lot of people ask, well, how far back can you go? Well, I'm not going to write off your cell phone from 3 years ago when you had the brainiac idea to buy a rental property. That's too far back. So what I want to do is make sure that it's reasonable. The time period hasn't been too long. And so in the last 6 to 9 months, you may have done some education. You may have bought a new laptop, bought a new drone, a new camera, set up a website. All those expenses are a startup cost. So track them and make sure you're talking about it with your accountant. And a spreadsheet, a yellow pad is fine. Last point, Matt, I'll just say this in summary. How do you write them off? What the IRS and the legislature, the government, Congress has said is you can write off the first $5,000 the day of your first sale. So let's say you've got that lemonade stand and you've spent $900 getting your lemonade stand ready to go and you sell one cup of lemonade for a dollar. Well, up to $5,000 of those expenses are now a write-off on that first day. So you've got $1 of income and $900 in write-offs, you have an $899 loss at the end of your first hour being in business. If you have more than $5,000 of startup costs, you have to amortize that. So if you had $7,000 in startup costs, you get $5,000 as a write-off in the first year, as soon as you make a sale. The remaining $2,000 are amortized or spread out over 15 years. Now you may say, well, that sucks. Well, the day you close the business, all those startup costs are a write-off. So I have some clients that 3 years in, they change the business model a little bit, we'll hit reset, all those startup costs are now a write-off, and we start fresh with a new business. So there's ways to get that off the books in a strategic way too. So again, as you can see, it can get a little complex, but here's the point, track it, people. It's a wonderful write-off. Don't forget about it. Use any method you can to write them down and then talk about them with your tax professional. Bam, I'm dropping the mic. There you go.
Love it.
I love it. Hurt anybody's eardrums.
Yeah. thank you for that audio, that little audio bump.
Trying to make the experience more real.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know. It's like your, what do they call it? Dab. That's like dabbing when you just scored. You just like to tap your mic. That's your signature move now.
Oh, okay. Oh, I like it. Okay.
All right. Well, I've got the legal tip.
A legal tip that you can actually use.
A legal tip where you don't feel like you have to take a shower after.
All right. Now, the legal tip, I want to talk about attorney-client privilege. This is an important one. When you're talking to your lawyer, you're in a sticky situation, you got some issues. Maybe it's the IRS. Maybe hopefully you don't have a criminal situation, but I get it. It happens. There are, that happens. None of you listeners though, of course. And, or maybe it's even a divorce or it's a business dispute, potential litigation situation. When is your communication with your lawyer, attorney, client privileged? Okay. Really important. Now let me give an example of why this is important. Remember President Trump and his attorney, Michael Cohen, who got arrested and his house got raided and his office got raided? Well, wasn't this Trump's lawyer? This is one of these questions. But then the courts allowed the prosecutors to go in and seize documents and records of his attorney. And this was back before Trump was president, of course, this the information they were seeking. So here's what's important of when the attorney-client privilege will prevail. First, you have to be seeking legal advice, okay? You can't be seeking business advice. And for those that may have, their own in-house lawyer or that situation, that's a gray area, is the advice and the information being exchanged, legal advice. Now, presumably it is. Let's say you have an IRS situation and you're communicating with a lawyer, let's say our law firm, about a tax issue or something like that. Now, that's attorney-client privilege. The IRS can't subpoena or receive our records. On the other hand, let's say you're talking to your CPA. You have a tax issue. The IRS can subpoena all your CPA's records. Okay? So if you're in a sticky situation, you do not want to be dealing with your CPA as to really sensitive information that could be attorney-client privilege, particularly if it's possibly a criminal situation, you need to be talking to a lawyer.
Okay. Now, Matt, I want to ask you a question because I know you're into this topic a little bit more than me and you've researched it for some clients recently. Like any good podcast show on legal and tax advice, we're going to go back to Breaking Bad. Now, if I remember correctly, it was either in the second or third episode of the first season, Jesse Pinkman and Walter White, need a lawyer. And they take Saul, Better Call Saul, Saul Goodman, out into the desert, and they don't know what they're doing. This is another underlying theme of Breaking Bad, is that if you were going to be a criminal, this is probably how you do it. You'd screw it up like any normal American. They don't think like criminals when they are a criminal.
Yeah.
And Saul Goodman is hilarious in this scene because they've got him over this hole they dug and they're threatening him. And he says, hold on, I can be your lawyer. Put a dollar in my pocket. Just put a dollar in my pocket. And they're like, what are you talking about? And it's this hilarious scene where he goes, now anything you tell me is attorney-client privilege. And they're like, okay. And so anyway, you gotta watch that scene. It goes on and on. But I want to ask, does consideration have to pass hands to make it effective? For example, I'm at a family reunion next weekend and my brother-in-law comes up and says, Mark, I got to talk to you about my wife. I'm going to get a divorce. Well, right there, that's legal advice. I'm a lawyer and he's talking to me about a legal matter. I could get in big trouble if I go tell grandpa that, oh, look at your son-in-law is trying to divorce your daughter. You know, boom, all of a sudden it blows up. I'm in trouble. Is that true? Do I have to take a dollar from him? What goes on there?
No, you do not necessarily have to accept payment. There just has to be agreement that you're providing legal services to them. So presumably that's, I don't know on your example there. That was a terrible example. I appreciate you throwing that out.
What? That was a great example. This happens to you all the time. You're at a family, your family asks you for advice all the time. Is that attorney-client privilege?
I don't know. I have no idea. What? Because there has to be an understanding that you're their attorney, right? So now, do they think that you're their attorney, but that you do it for free? I mean, it's not about payment necessarily. I know that's what,
it's about the relationship.
That was from Breaking Bad. That's not necessarily an accurate example, but there just has to be an agreement, understanding that you're their lawyer. So do they presume you're just their free lawyer? Probably. But there has to be that understanding. Now, let me hit a couple other things I think are, I at least do know. And thanks for throwing that curveball at me.
Well, I didn't think it was a curveball. I'd still want to follow up on a piece there, but you go with this a little further because I want to ask a follow-up. Go ahead.
Okay. But if it's about your brother-in-law, the family reunion, I'm going to pass.
No. But let me say this then. Let me say this. Okay. Is it in the eyes of the client? Really, it's in the eye. If the brother-in-law thought, hey, Mark, I'm looking to you as my lawyer here. I might get a divorce. In his mind, he's talking to me as if I'm his lawyer. Isn't the definition what he thought, not what I thought? If I was a smart lawyer,
there has to be an agreement that you're providing legal services, that you're their lawyer. Yeah. So I think there'd have to be a mutual agreement between both.
So if I'm a good lawyer, I'd say, hey, the final point.
Because you can't have your brother-in-law come up to you and be like, I confess to killing your sister. And you're like, well, am I your lawyer? Can I disclose that now? Or is my, you know what I mean? So there has to be a mutual agreement between the two. He can't just presume that he's, you know, you're his free lawyer.
So anybody out there that's listening, this is the takeaway for me. And this is really important. Thank you, Matt. Is that anybody
keep going.
That is not a lawyer, when you go up and ask your family member or friend that's a lawyer on the golf course, at the family reunion, at the dinner party, wherever it is, if you want it privileged, you better say, hey, can this be a privileged conversation? Even though it's free advice, I'd like to talk to you as if you're my lawyer. Can you give me a piece of advice? You'd have to have him say or her say, yes, now we have a relationship. Then it would be protected. But if you just start asking questions, you may not have protection. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's right. And that's in the example, the Breaking Bad example, that happened. The dollar was just a symbol of the agreement between the two of them, right? So, all right, let me go over the other important tips, though. Here's an exception to the attorney-client privilege, is if a third party non-lawyer is present during the conversation, the attorney-client privilege does not apply. So let's say you're having a conversation with your lawyer and you have a third party there who's not part of the legal conversation, a consultant, a CPA, whatever it may be. That conversation is no longer privileged. So it has to be exclusive between you and your lawyer or lawyers. Hmm. Now, the last one is if your lawyer is in on the crime, like Saul Goodman was, that privilege does not apply. So because he knew that you were committing a crime and he was not only keeping it secret, he was being a part of it too. So,
and that goes back to the Trump situation.
And that goes back to the Trump situation of Michael Cohen, who also got indicted for criminal activity. And that's why attorney-client privilege exactly did not apply in that situation.
So if Saul Goodman would have given him advice to protect them, that's one thing. But if Saul Goodman was participating to launder money, like he ultimately did.
Right, like he hooked him up with the car wash and told him to do the car wash to launder the money and you need a business and
yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Well, mm-hmm. Exciting.
Attorney-client privilege.
Man. You know, my son and I were in New York and we bumped into, I forgot his name. oh my gosh, the actor that plays Jesse Pinkman.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I forgot his real name. I feel bad. And
Aaron something.
Yeah, Aaron. And someone's got it right there. We should Google it. But anyway, we bumped into him at a store in New York City. It was a drone kind of electronic store. Mm-hmm. And he was a total cool guy. I mean, my son was like, hey, you're Jesse Pinkman. And he's like, I'm Aaron, whatever. You know, he's like, but he played it off. He was cool. And it's his only real part he's ever played. And he's been in a couple movies, but nothing blockbuster like
Brian nothing Cranston. Like that. Yeah.
But anyway, he was pretty cool. He was like, yeah, what's going on? And he chummed it up and talked with my son for a while. And it was pretty cool. So anyway, great show on the legal industry as well. Lots of little Saul Goodman takeaways.
Yeah, lots of funny stuff that attorneys will definitely laugh at and appreciate.
Okay.
Cool. Should we get into the private lending?
The topic du jour?
Yeah.
And you're supposed to say?
Well, it's the main course. We just finished the soup du jour. So
okay. So I say, do you want to move on from the soup du jour? And you say,
That sounds nice.
Gosh, you're not in the mood today. You got to be quoting movies right and left.
I don't know if that's the right setup, but
it was close. I mean, whenever you say soup du jour, you go, sounds good. That's not Breaking Bad. That is Dumb and Dumber.
That's an automatic.
I'm in a weird mood today, I guess. All right. Well, okay. Lenders. Okay. Now, Matt, you said we should talk about those who are lending first. Then we'll talk about some of you that are borrowing money.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is one of those things where we're sometimes contradictory, because what we're going to tell you to lend may be the exact opposite of what we're going to say to borrow. In some ways. And so that's why I wanted, let's separate these things out so we don't confuse people. All right, let's talk about lending. We'll just volley back and forth, you know? I'll hit a couple tips. My first tip, and this is like my overriding tip whenever anybody's lending and you're starting out in it, is WWBD. Remember, WWBD. What would the bank do? Okay. Okay. Why does the bank make you jump through all those hoops? Why do they run the credit on a borrower? Why do they appraise a property when a property is being loaned against? Why do they make sure a title company is involved and that their loan is placed in first or second position, depending on how they're loaning? If it's a rental property, why do they look at the rental income and make sure it stands up to comps in the area? Why do they do a judgment search and make sure there's no liens or other things on the property in priority? Why do they do all those things? Because they want to get paid back, okay? Yeah. And those are all things you want to look at that can affect whether you're actually going to get paid back.
Yeah.
Right? So always think of that. What did the bank make me do when I asked them for money?
Yeah. Now, I know you're not going to want to think that way, people, because you think, it's such a headache, or I don't know what to do. You know, what does a bank really do? You know, and that could be a little unsettling. Well, let me just make some general comments here too before we get into the exact documents you should need. Is, first of all, people, this is money you've worked hard to earn and put in the bank. And it could be a retirement account. It could be just hard-earned money that's sitting in an after-tax account. And meaning you've paid tax on it before and it's just sitting there and you're investing it, or you're going to give someone a loan. People, if you're going to loan it to anyone other than family, go through the proper procedures. And I'm going to say this for all of you out there borrowing, because we're going to come to it. If you want to have a good experience with a lender, help them do it right. Don't try to cut corners. Whenever corners get cut, it gets ugly. And so just go into it with the mindset, you know what? I might have to hire an attorney for an hour. You know, just, I'm going to loan $10,000. I'm going to loan $100,000. You'd be shocked how many people in the last 2 weeks I've talked to that have loaned $100,000 and they not once thought to call their lawyer. They just took whatever the borrower gave them to sign and, let me wire you money. I trust this guy or gal. They're in my church. They're in my neighborhood. They're in my real estate club. They wouldn't rip me off. Wrong. You've got to go through the steps properly.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know what? Sometimes those people have looked for money and other people have checked their background. They found out that they filed bankruptcy 2 years ago. They looked at the property and realized there's already three loans against it. You know, they said, I'm not going to loan. And so you don't want to be the dumb one at the end here that finally gives them the money that they're asking for and gets left holding the bag because it wasn't a type of person you would loan to. So, okay. So first think, what would the bank do? Now I want to say on a lot of those things, I know that sound like a task list. It is. I'm sorry. You need to get an appraisal or have some third party opinion eval. Maybe even just hire a broker or agent that can give you a quick idea of the value of the property. Now, remember, what does the bank do? The bank makes the borrower pay for the appraisal. If you go to the bank and ask for money, they're going to say, you got to get an appraisal. And in fact, we're going to pick that appraiser and you're going to pay them. Okay. We do the same thing as a private lender, and most good hard money private lenders do that. They're going to make you pay for that. And you can keep it on the cheap. If you're lending $10,000 or $20,000, maybe at least get a real estate agent to say, hey, can you take a look at this property? Give me an idea of value. I don't need a full appraisal. But now the second thing I would say, and this is, I think, solved a lot of problems for people. Use a third party title or escrow company, or, you know, some states have attorneys that do the closings, but use a third party that escrows the money and is going to record your deed of trust or mortgage on the property. If you are lending on real property, if someone says, I'm doing a real estate deal and I want you to loan money, you have got to get a mortgage or deed of trust on the property. That is your lien that ensures you're going to get paid back. I've seen clients that loan money for a real estate deal and they don't get a lien on property. And guess what? If that property doesn't sell like the investor thinks it's going to, who's the one not getting paid? Them? Nope. You.
Okay. And Matt, as we keep talking back and forth, I love this. We're going to break this down a little. I'm going to do a little more simple here because I know someone's listening that's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Deed of trust, what the hell? Okay, let's just go basic here for 1 second too. Someone walks up to you and says, I want to borrow $5,000, $10,000. Number one, if there's no security, that's the first thing you want to think. And when we say security, I mean, is there collateral? Are they going to give you the title to their car? Are they going to give you the stock in their business? Or are they going to give you a lien against their home or some sort of real estate? That's what we call security or collateral. Now, let's just say there's no collateral. You're just going to loan someone money. Bare minimum, get a promissory note, a well-drafted that says when they're going to pay you back, how much they're going to pay you, what happens if they're late, who pays for attorney fees, and it could be 1 to 2 pages. And we'll help you do that. In a half hour to an hour as an attorney, we would help you get a good promissory note finalized. It does not have to be notarized, although we recommend it. Just get a good promissory note that they sign and you sign before you give them the money.
Yeah.
That alone.
The lender doesn't need to sign the promissory note. Yeah. But the borrower signs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bare minimum. And unsecured notes are the most, you know, where you don't get a lien on property or anything, are the, you know, the most risky. So you make sure you're getting a good interest rate. And I've even talked to clients that have paid for a consult. They're like, hey, I want to do a loan for 10 grand to this person. And I go through all the stuff I think they should do. And I'm like, looking at the end of the day, how much you're going to make, it's not worth the risk. For $10,000, a $10,000 loan on a real estate deal where you're secured in third position. And it's like, I don't know, that's the best use of your money. So sometimes you do need to say no. And the small dollar loans may not be worth the hassle in my mind. Yeah. Now, if he's the friend or, you know, there's a sweetheart family thing you're getting out of it, there's other deals you can be working for that, I'm cool with it. Or you're just okay with a little higher risk scenario. But those, I don't know. I sometimes kind of talk people out of those a little bit.
Yep. Now, and here's what's going to happen. You're going to say, well, Mark, they're giving me 1 point, which is 1% of the loan face, maybe 2 points. So if it's $10,000, they're going to give me $200. Then they're going to pay me 10% interest per annum, meaning over a year's time. So if they keep the money all year long, they're going to pay me $1,000 in interest plus 2 points. So you'll make $1,200 on your $10,000. That's a simple example. So if to make $1,200, that's how I do it. In 2 points and 10% throughout the year. Now, you want to say, okay, well, when are you going to pay me back? And the terms and all those things. And you want to go through that and then ask, are you going to secure this? Are you going to give me a personal guarantee. Well, I'm just going to borrow, my business is going to borrow it. Now, right there, that's a red flag, because if their business borrows it from you and they can't pay it back, you really don't have anywhere to go, because the business could just be a shell. So you want to ask, can I get a personal guarantee at the bare minimum?
Great point.
And then you may say, and you know, they're going to say, well, all right, well, you don't need a lawyer. We can just do this ourselves. And you're going to say, oh, man, I just don't know. And you feel a little crazy about it. And so if there's going to be collateral, like a car loan or inventory from a business or something, that's called a UCC type loan, where you're going to do a lien against non-real property. And you want to make sure you understand what that process is like. But if it's going to be for real estate, that's where the promissory note is going to be tied to a trust deed. And that's what Matt referenced a moment ago.
Or a mortgage, trust deed, depending on your state,
mortgage trust deed, is going to be recorded in the against the property, so that if they default, you can foreclose on the property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, that personal guarantee that Mark mentioned, if the borrower is a business or someone's LLC, that is a huge issue. Presumably, you're not loaning to a publicly traded company that has tons of assets and audited financials and all this. You're loaning to a small business or another investor. And let's be honest, they're using that LLC for asset protection. They're using it so that if something goes wrong in their business, they don't have to personally pay. Well, do you want to accept that deal? Do you want to have a limited, you know, not get paid back? Definitely not. So make the business owner sign a personal guarantee. It's very common. Any commercial bank loaning to small business or medium-sized businesses makes the owners of that company that own 20% or more sign a personal guarantee. So that's not an unreasonable request on the lender side.
Yeah, and I want to throw this out too, that at if any point they go, don't you trust me? Do we really have to go through this paperwork? That's when you say, you know what, I just don't feel comfortable about this, or my husband or wife won't let me do this, or my mom or dad, or my brother or sister, or my lawyer, and blame someone and say, you know what, my money's deployed somewhere else. Just get out and be really cautious. And now let me give one example here that in the last few weeks I've been dealing with that's really frustrating, is that a real estate flipper got 5 or 6 loans from people. And most of them were just this personal loan. There was no collateral. The trust deeds were not recorded. There was not even a first position or second position or anything. And this, the people that just loaned the money trust the person. He's so important. He's such a good guy. He would never rip me off, sort of thing. And so all these people that lent money are now in line going, what the freak? Where's our money? And it's created a lot of stress on this person that had good intentions but didn't follow the proper steps. And so this is a little transitionary point, is if you're going to borrow money from people, it's just as important that you go through the steps as well, because you don't need people pounding down your door and threatening you with lawsuits, and all of a sudden it's Harry Caray and you're like, oh my gosh, I never expected this problem to occur. Guys, you have to expect the unexpected. Plan for the unexpected. Document for the unexpected. If it doesn't happen, then great. But if it does, you've got a contingency plan. You have an emergency plan. You have an escape plan. It's just like a fire that could happen in a building. You've got to have an escape route. And that's what a good promissory note does.
Yeah. Whew. Okay. Well, hopefully we're not scaring you. We just want you to be ready. You know, I want you to be fit when you hit the field of private lending. We want you to be, you know, ready to take some hits and catch and run, you know, score some points. So, okay. Anything you want to say on the lender side? I had one other comment on that.
I do too. Here's where I see a big problem occur. Now, why Matt said you want to get a third party escrow company or an attorney that does closings that can do a title search for you. The reason why you want to do that. Now, of course, this is not for your typical $10,000 loan. That's why Matt says it may not be worth it for just a little $10,000 loan. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to loan someone 50 to 100 grand, and they're doing a fix and flip or a rehab, and they say, you're in first position. What that means is there's no other loans against that property. You're first in line. Or they say you're second in line or third in line. They can tell you that, but you want to verify. Trust, but verify. You always want to verify
Ronald Reagan. Telling you.
Yeah. And this is where a third party escrow company will come in. They'll do what's called a title search. And for it's very affordable. They'll pull title and they'll go, ooh, guess what? This property, because you've done your appraisal, so you know the property's worth 200 grand as is, and they do a title search and they go, oh my gosh, there's three other loans in here. Someone loaned 100 grand, someone else loaned 50 grand, and someone else loaned 75 grand. There's $225,000 of loans already recorded in line, and this property is only worth 200. Buddy, whew, run away. And so if you don't see enough equity in this property where you could go in, sell the property and pay off all the lien holders in front of you, it's not a good loan. And that's what a third party is going to help you determine, is that you're protected.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, there's something else I was going to say and I can't remember what it was. What were you going to say for lenders?
I want you to get a better understanding and do almost an application for the borrower. I think a lot of times it's like, well, I know this person. Do you really? Do you know if they've filed bankruptcy in the last 7 years? Do you know if they've been convicted of a crime? Do you know what their annual income is? Do you know what other liabilities they have? You can get an application online. You know, even if, you know, for many of you that are real estate investors, you do it when you put in a tenant, you know, get an application. Why is that application important? What happens if they don't pay you back? You want some ways to chase down their assets. Okay. So get an application that they sign off for. That's a helpful thing to have in your records. And it's a good little check on what they're doing. And you may do a credit check as part of that and authorize a credit check if you want to check their credit and get a credit score on them too.
Yeah. Let's talk practically here too. This is cool. I just got a fun, because here's the thing. Matt and I are not trying to scare you from lending. We just want you to do it right. And I have a lot of clients that make a ton of money lending. Now, let me tell you the way to do it. Why are they coming to you? Ask yourself, why is this person coming to me going, I need 100 grand or I need 50 grand? It's because the bank's not going to give it to them, or they don't want to go through the time. Maybe they're in a rush. Fine. So you want to say to yourself, if you're coming to me and you want me to move quickly and save the time of going to the bank, it's going to cost you more. If you want a 3% or 4% or 5% loan, go to the freaking bank. Go get in line. But if you're coming to me, I got to get points up front, at least 1 or 2 points for my time. So that's why they say 100 grand, you're going to pay 1 or 2 points, which is $1,000 or $2,000 just to have me write the loan. Then you're going to pay me interest of 8%, 10%, or 12%. Well, I don't want to pay that much in interest. Oh, well, then sorry, don't do it with me. That's your terms. Oh, yeah. Matt, I remembered what I was going to say. Okay, so when someone comes to borrow money from you, they're going to say, oh, I'll give you 10% and 2 points, but I'll give you a piece of the action on the backside. So when we sell this property, you're going to get 20%. Okay, well, folks, that's not a loan anymore. You're now a business partner, because your return is really based on the productivity of this project and if it's going to be profitable. And if there's a lawsuit that breaks out, guess who the lawyers are going to sue? They're going to come after you and say, you're a partner on this. Well, I'm not a partner. I'm just a lender. Really? Do you get 20% of the profit? Yeah. Well, that's called a general partner. That's a participating note, AKA partnership, AKA you're liable for some dumbass move that happens on the property. Sorry, children listening. There's asses or mules. They're in the Bible, and it's a Bible word that's used once in a while. It means mule, meaning dumb.
Oh, okay. I was more disturbed by your use of AKA back to back, AKA, AKA.
otherwise known as. Yeah, okay.
Well, those are great points. Cal, this is good. This is good. Oh yeah. One other point I was just going to say on that made me think of something when you talk about the partnership is, now sometimes that can be a cool thing. I've seen clients that have done it, been successful. They do the note, kind of the equity kicker provision in it. And they're still getting it secured on the property. They're still getting a lien. But what they also do is they're using an LLC. That's what they're lending out of. And so for asset protection purposes, usually as a lender, just a pure lender, you don't need an entity for asset protection. But if you're doing an equity kicker deal or some profit sharing where Mark said you're going to be a general partner, we don't want you personally on that note. So you could use an LLC in that scenario if you're going down the kind of equity kicker profit sharing type note structures as a lender.
Yeah.
All right.
But you just have to, again, get a legal consult once in a while. And until you're in the rhythm of doing a lot of loans, if this is your first loan, pay up front to get a little advice. With most of our attorneys, you can talk for a half hour, an hour, tell them what you're doing. And so many times, Matt, isn't this happened to you? The client gets on the phone and starts to explain what they're doing. And about halfway through, they're like, this is dumb, isn't it? I didn't say that.
Yeah. Once you're like five or six questions in, they're like, I don't think I want to do this deal. And but we are very creative planners when it comes to attorneys. So we're trying to find ways to get deals done. We just want to get done in the best way possible. So, but let's transition over to the borrower now. Now, how do I get a private loan? You know, what should I be thinking about as a borrower of a private loan? And this is where, you know, forget what we just said before, because some of the things are going to be contradictory. For example, I'll just give the first one. Don't sign a personal guarantee. If you're a real estate investor or a business owner and you're using an LLC or a corporation, an S corporation, have the company get the loan, right? Yeah. The company's going to use the money. It's going to go for the company's assets. Do I want you to sign a personal guarantee? Heck no. Not unless they ask you.
Yeah. And this is where it gets tricky, because if you're borrowing money from people, you would think we would say, hey, if you get some sucker to loan you money, do it. And no personal guarantee. Get it on a napkin at Denny's. Believe it or not, we don't say that, because here's why. If you have any sort of reputation in the community, if you don't plan on skipping town and living out of your car and moving to Denver tomorrow, if you don't have any scruples, then go that route. I mean, if you can get some bozo to loan you money, do it. But if you're going to call us, our goal is to make sure that even if something goes wrong, you still look legitimate. You look like you weren't a crook. Because when you start cutting corners and something does go wrong, people get nasty. And they're going to call the local prosecutor. They may get the media involved. If you have a position of power or influence, or you're a licensed professional in any way, you got to think about your character and reputation, because if it goes bad and you did cut corners, not good. And we don't want clients that are living out of a car, borrowing money from people and skipping town. That's not the type of client we want. So as a borrower, you're better off to help the lender do it right, because what are they going to do when the loan's done? They're going to come back to you again and again. And all of a sudden you have these resources to borrow from whenever you need to, because you did it right the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Let me hit a couple other tips on the borrower side. So you're out borrowing money. Let's say you've got you're raising money for your business, or you need money to rehab a property, you're fixing and flipping, whatever the case may be. The documents are really important for you. And many times the lender is going to provide the documents. And they may say, well, my attorney reviewed them, as Mark mentioned earlier, I think. Have your own attorney look at them just so you get an understanding of what you're agreeing to. At the end of the day, I think a lot of people are surprised. Isn't there some law or some statute that governs this on how I pay back and what the laws are? Isn't there a case, like Jones v. Smith, that's going to determine how, this loan works? No, it's what you guys put on a piece of paper and sign between the two of you. That's what matters. So those documents are really, really important.
Let me comment on that point. It's interesting you said that, because I was just talking to a borrower yesterday, and he said, well, the loan was in arrears, and so I went and made a big payment. And he said, in my mind, I thought I had also covered the payments for the next month or two when I made this big payment. But the lender took the leftover amount and applied it to principal. And he called the lender and was like, what the freak? I just gave you a big check. That's we're good for 2 or 3 months. And he goes, no. Look at the terms of the note. If you pay me any money over and above the monthly payment, That goes towards principal. You can't prepay the payments unless you pay off the loan. Now, that was a fine print in the loan document, but that lender knew what the hell he was doing. And so he's trying to get every dollar he can out of that borrower because he's scared that he's not going to get his money back. So that's why you've got to review the note, even if you're on the borrowing side.
Wow, great point. The devil's always in the details in those things. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say on the borrower side, and sometimes we have this of clients who do a lot of fix and flip real estate deals, and they're continually kind of raising money using notes. This is really critical. Yeah, the documentation as a borrower is to protect you, not the lender. If you raise money frequently for real estate deals, I'm going to say it again. The loan and the mortgage and deed of trust are to protect you, not the lender. Because as a borrower, if you're out raising money that way, your deal goes bad, what's the lender going to say? This was a security. They're going to go to some lawyers and say, no, this is a security. You're out raising money. This is a security, and we're invoking securities laws, and we might refer you to state securities commissioners. And man, you're in a world of hurt now. What's your get out of jail free card, so to speak? It's not free, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean? Is, hey, I got a loan document and it was secured on the property. And properly. The loan I got was properly, yeah. And it was fully secured for the value. You know, I didn't get a $1 million loan for a property worth $100,000. You know, I got a $100,000 loan for a property worth $100,000. So there's a securities law exemption for that. So that documentation is there protecting you if you're someone out there who's continually raising money in this way. Really important for those people.
Yeah. And let me piggyback some of Matt's comments there. You want to watch out for the F word too. And I'm talking about fraud. Because think about if you're out taking bunches of loans from people and you're fix and flipping and you're using money on one property that you've secured to go use on another property. And then this... excuse me, and this, you're pooling money and then the property sold, but you keep their money and go to another property and everything's going great. So you're just flying fast and furious. And all of a sudden the music stops, the market adjusts, and there's some lenders out there and you're holding those notes and you don't have money to pay them back. And they start to get upset. They're going to go through several claims. Matt mentioned the security claim. They're going to go, well, this wasn't a loan. This was an investment. And you made promises. And I don't have a proper trustee. You just kept my money and rolled it into the next property. And you're going to go, well, we talked on the phone. You said it was okay. It's got to be in writing. Yeah. And then they're going to go, well, you text me or you called me. Blah. Doesn't matter. And then number two, if at any point they think you lied in the process, that's the F word, fraud. Then they're going to call the local prosecutor and go, this guy's took my money. He took my grandma's money. He's preying on older people, blah, blah, blah. Well, folks, if they've got nothing to do, that prosecutor that week, they come in guns a-blazing and ask, you know, make accusations and ask questions later. They don't jerk around with this sort of accusation. So you got to be really careful. And that's why Matt says the documents, and I'm going to say it even in a more unique way, the documents protect you, the borrower, from a claim against you personally. And the documents protect the lender's money. See, the documents are not there to protect the money for you. They're there to protect you from getting accused of fraud or securities this or that and keep you out of jail. The lender wants the documents not to protect them personally, but to protect their money. So they serve two different purposes. And you want to make sure you're getting the protection you need. So if something goes bad, you got to say, if this goes bad, what happens to me? Mm-hmm. Not the money.
I like that distinction. I like that distinction.
Well, you set it up, dude. You set it up. It was like a T-ball game. I mean, you walked out there, pulled out
that. Shake and bake, baby.
Yeah, shake and bake. Man.
Shake and bake.
Look, we've covered Dumb and Dumber, Breaking Bad, Talladega Nights. Oh, yeah, we got to cover, as usual, Jerry Maguire. Help us help you. Help us help you by doing good documentation.
Yeah. At the end of the day, that's all that matters. When you're going to court or you've got to enforce something, it's all about the documents.
No. I thought you were going to go into, I'm going to set it up for you. I thought you were going to go into A Few Good Men. You were going to say, at the end of the day, no, that's true. What's he say?
Doesn't matter what happened. It only matters what I can prove in court. Okay. And so what you talked about, what you emailed about, by the way, emails are not admissible typically. What you text about, also not admissible. Something called the parole evidence rule. But the documents are, well, the agreements you signed. So that's what's critical, and that's what you can prove in court. Tom Cruise, baby.
Yeah, two Tom Cruise quotes. Man, the guy's a master. He's a master. Everything he touches turns to gold. Except Eyes Wide Shut. That was just a bomb. I mean, but most everything, I mean, really.
Yeah, Michelle Top Gun.
Jack Reacher.
Maverick.
Maverick.
No, not Maverick. What was the
oh, Top Gun.
Race car one? Days of Thunder.
Days of Thunder, yeah, a little weak. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. He's a master. Okay. Well, everybody, let's just say this. Thank you for listening. We are your back office. We are your resource, hopefully, for tax and legal support. This is the only podcast we know of that really does dive in deep for the investor, the entrepreneur, from a legal and tax perspective with licensed professionals. There's other podcasters out there talking about some of this stuff, but we're the ones that actually have a license to do so with malpractice insurance and a fiduciary duty when we're on the phone with you to do to recommend what's best for you. So we hope that you can find this podcast a resource and share it with your friends and family. Please do. We love it. It's our passion, and we're just so excited to be here with you today. And Matt, any final words as the music rolls?
No, just give us that 5-star review. If you have any constructive feedback, you can send those emails to mark@kqslawyers.com. That's M-A-R-K @kqslawyers.com. But thanks so much.
And I'll forward them on to Matt. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.